2001 Salt Lake Sunscreen Symposium, Session 311, Defending Magic, Explaining the Necessity of Ordinances. Participants are Dennis Potter and Paul Montclair.
Dennis Potter will be giving a paper, Defending Magic, Explaining the Necessity of Ordinances. And we'll be hearing comments from Randy Paul, also known as Paul Montclair. Dennis did his bachelor's degree at BYU. I see BS listed here. Oh, no, this is you. Right. Bachelor's degree in philosophy and a master's, which is BS, right? Bachelor's degree in philosophy, a master's degree also in philosophy at the Florida State University, and a PhD at University of Notre Dame. He's currently teaching at UVSC and is the ward mission leader down in Spanish Fork in his ward. He has a wife and two kids, and we'll be glad to hear from him. Randy Paul did his bachelor's degree also at BYU, an MBA at Harvard, and then a PhD at the University of Chicago in the Committee on Social Thought. In social theory and religion. He was in the bishopric in my favorite BYU student ward and went on to be a bishop in another student ward nearby where he learned a few things. And he's currently the executive director of the Foundation for Interreligious Diplomacy, trying to improve the way that religious conflict is engaged in. So we'll be glad to hear from these two. Dennis.
I'm just going to read it right from my computer because, well, I'm too lazy to print it out. It's not that my printer wasn't working or anything, I just didn't want to do it. I'm surprised that there's this many people here because I heard that last night the session on Albert Peck went really late and that it was very good, but it just went late into the evening, and it's good to see that you guys were willing to wake up to hear about defending magic. In this paper, I want to deal with what I see as a big gap in Christian theology in general and in LDS theology in particular. The gap is in explaining the moral necessity of religious ordinances or sacraments. We call them ordinances. Catholics call them sacraments. In this paper, I will explore three possible avenues of solution. I will argue that the only theory that can explain the necessity of ordinances is the one that is the most difficult to believe, at least for me. My method will be analytic, and I will not, in this paper, muddle around in scriptural interpretation. That's not to say that I do not think that any view of ordinances should answer to the data found in scriptures. I do think that that's the case, but I don't have time to do that. Some definitions. By ordinance, I mean a ritualized action that is supposed to have religious significance. To say that an ordinance is efficacious is to say that the ordinance is successful in achieving its purpose. Generally, the purpose of an ordinance is to make us better people. It should be clear, I think, that ordinances are often efficacious, even if only psychosomatically. The question is how they are efficacious and whether or not this entails that they are also necessary. The sense in which we claim that ordinances are necessary is that they are supposed to be necessary for salvation, or that is, in LDS terminology, exaltation. Ordinances are individualized with respect to necessity, that is, the performance of a certain ordinance for me is necessary for my salvation, and a separate instance of the same kind of ordinance must be performed for you in order for you to be saved. Ordinances are not thought to be sufficient for salvation, however. Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, and Mormonism all claim that there are ordinances that are necessary for salvation. For Mormonism, it's baptism, confirmation, sacrament, endowment, temple marriage. The question is, how are these ordinances efficacious? what is the mechanism by which they work, and why should they be necessary for salvation? And the hope is that once we understand how they work, that will give us a clue as to why they're necessary. The significance problem. There are two problems with the proposition that ordinances are necessary. The first problem is a fairly common one, and I doubt that anyone here has not thought about it at one time or another. I will call this the significance problem, or you could call it the moral significance problem. Perhaps the best way to see this problem is to think about what I'll call the case of the recalcitrant saint. In this case, there is a Catholic who, like Mother Teresa, spends her whole life in the service of humanity. She dies believing that Catholic theology is true. So in the spirit prison, she rejects the LDS missionaries. She thinks she's in purgatory or limbo or something. Is she to be denied salvation on the basis of this action? It seems absurd to say yes. In fact, faithful Latter-day Saints who want to answer this question are often tempted with the idea that people like Mother Teresa will eventually accept the message and the LDS ordinances. In fact, I'd say invariably Mormons say that. They say, oh yeah, they'll eventually accept it. This is to deny the very possibility of the case of the recalcitrant saint. This denial seems very implausible, at least to me, but it is a way of avoiding the absurdity of saying that the recalcitrant saint will be denied salvation. All good people will think like us in the end. I think that the reason that we think that a recalcitrant saint shouldn't be denied a place in the celestial kingdom is that there is a difference between the moral significance of the life actions of the saint and the action of an ordinance. Saintly actions, such as feeding the poor, are prima facie morally good. There's something about the action that makes it good, that, for example, it relieves suffering or something, or it makes you a better person. But the action of performing an ordinance is prima facie neither morally good nor morally evil, and hence it is not morally significant. Indeed, in and of itself, being immersed in water does not seem as though it should have any effect on whether or not someone is a good person, or I guess it would relieve suffering during the summer. But here in a couple of months, it probably won't relieve suffering. So in and of itself, it's not a good action. Anticipating later discussion, one might argue that it is not the immersion itself, but the symbolism that is important. However, many things could symbolize the same thing in this case. That is, the death and of the life of sin and the rebirth into a new life. So the mere fact that ordinances are symbolic does not explain why they would be necessary. That's the first problem. Second problem, then, the conventional problem. The second problem with the claim that ordinances are necessary is not as common as the first problem, since it depends on some technical notions, although some of you may have thought of this problem as well. And I'm going to call it the conventional problem. As we already mentioned, ordinances are symbolic. But this means that they are conventional in the sense that we could have picked many different kinds of actions to serve as the ordinances. For example, instead of immersion in water, we could have picked the burying of artifacts associated with one's sins. So I take all my beer bottles and out in the backyard and dig a hole and throw them in and bury them. To put it another way, the kind of actions that we pick to be ordinances seem to be arbitrary. But what is arbitrary and conventional certainly can't be necessary, since it could have been otherwise, it could have been different. One might point out that there are necessities that exist internally to any given symbolic system. For example, in English, all bachelors are unmarried is necessarily true. This is the case even if the word bachelor means what it means in English only by the conventions that we have adopted. So by convention, something could be necessarily true. And in fact, some philosophers have argued that all necessary truth is to be explained in this way. However, this observation, I think, will not help in solving the conventional problem. This is because the necessity that is supposed to attach to an ordinance is not merely the necessary truth of a proposition, but rather the necessity of the ordinance being a prerequisite for salvation. So I think it's apples and oranges here. Okay. So now let's talk about the possible theories to solve these two problems. In order to explain how ordinances are necessary, we will need to formulate a theory of how ordinances work that solves the significance problem and the conventional problem. I'm going to entertain three. I said in the abstract four, but the fourth theory seems to be, in my view, just a kind of a weird variation on one of the other theories, so I got rid of it. I claim that two of these theories seem to be plausible explanations of how ordinances are efficacious, but do not explain how the ordinances are necessary. The third theory does explain how ordinances are necessary, but is perhaps a less plausible explanation of how ordinances are efficacious. The psychological theory. The first theory as to how ordinances are efficacious is that they affect us psychologically. The idea is that baptism, for example, might cause a psychological change in the person that affects this person's moral nature. In this way, the significance problem is solved, since baptism becomes a morally significant action insofar as it affects our moral character. Clearly, even if the psychological theory is not the only reason why baptism is efficacious, it is at least one of the reasons that it is. Indeed, anything can affect a change in someone if they think that it will cause a change. We've all seen baptism cause a psychological change in people, right? However, the problem with the psychological theory should be obvious. If the psychological theory gives us the explanation for why ordinances are efficacious, then it does not explain why they are necessary. One problem is that psychology is not universal. Doesn't seem so, at least. In particular, what affects one person in one way does not affect another person in the same way. So the fact that baptism may morally change some people does not mean that it will change everyone. A second and perhaps worse problem for this theory is the fact that baptism can affect us, is the fact that if baptism can affect us psychologically, making us better people, then so can any number of other actions. 12-step programs, for example. Why should baptism be necessary for everyone? Therefore, it should be clear that the psychological theory does not, at least on its face, respond to the conventional problem. One response to these criticisms is what I'll call the hardwired response. The idea behind this response is to say that psychology is universal. I was wrong earlier. Everyone's hardwired so that the act of baptism will affect them morally. However, it's not clear how this helps to respond to the fact that many things can affect us psychologically, unless the hardwired response also includes the claim that people are hardwired so that only baptism will affect them in a morally positive way. Now, this response is getting really implausible. Indeed, it should be called the hypnosis response, since it sounds as if it claims that God hypnotized us before this life so that we would have a universal and exclusive reaction to baptism. Sort of, you know, when I snap my fingers, you're going to become a good person, that kind of thing. Another problem with the hardwired response is that it makes ordinances necessary at the expense of explaining why they are morally significant. Indeed, why should God hardwire us so that baptism will have a positive moral effect on us? What is so morally significant about baptism? The hardwired response does not answer this question. Another response admits that the psychological effects of baptism are not universal, but that they are common enough that God requires them for everybody. Perhaps he requires, this is my wife's response, she brought this up. Perhaps he requires them for everybody just to make things simpler. Of course, this response seems to be problematic, she doesn't think so, because it does not seem fair for those who are in the psychological minority. These people can change without baptism, or alternatively, they won't even be affected by baptism. God should treat them differently because they are in a different situation. This seems to indicate that to the extent that we can solve the moral significance problem, we fail to solve the conventional problem, and vice versa. The problems work against each other. Indeed, consider both of these responses to the problems encountered by the psychological theory. These responses explain the necessity of ordinances in terms of the psychological theory only to run up against a kind of moral arbitrariness. Why would God hardwire us so that baptism is necessary? Why would God treat those for whom baptism does not work the same as those for whom it does? So I fail to see that there are any other responses to the psychological or to the problems of the psychological theory that would work here. So I conclude tentatively that the psychological theory, in its most plausible form, does not explain why baptisms are necessary. This theory is, however, a very plausible theory as to how ordinances are efficacious. Certainly there is a psychological effect that results from these kinds of symbolic acts. Of course, at this point, one might give up the necessity of ordinances. and just say, well, it's good that we generally do it because it affects so many people, but really when it comes down to it, God's going to let people into the celestial kingdom without baptism if they're like Mother Teresa and they decide not to get baptized or whatever. And in an audience like this, Sunstone audience might not be adverse to such a move. However, for those of us who take Mormon theology seriously, I had to slam my audience at least at one point. For those of us who take Mormon theology seriously, we need another way out, I think. The contract theory. The main idea behind the contract theory is the idea of a social contract. Social contract theory, as opposed to just the contract theory, goes back to Thomas Hobbes at least, and centers on the claim that morality comes about as a result of a, perhaps tacit, contract that is made between moral agents. According to this theory, you do something wrong only because you break a tacit agreement that you have made. Now, applying this idea to the problem of the efficacy of ordinances, we might claim that participating in an ordinance is like signing the dotted line of a contract. And then by doing this, one puts oneself under obligations that might not exist otherwise. This makes the act of participating in an ordinance a morally significant event. This is what makes an ordinance efficacious. And clearly, this does give us response to the significant problem, since it entails that ordinances are morally significant. One problem with the contract theory of ordinance is the problem of different signatures. It is not clear why only baptism can count as a signing of the contract. Indeed, can't I just say, I hereby commit myself to do all the same things that people being baptized commit themselves to do, and thereby be included in precisely the same contract as those who are baptized? To put it another way, it is not clear that the social contract theory responds to the conventional problem. Can you imagine if you're on your mission and someone said that? Yeah, I want to join your church, but I don't want to be baptized. I'll just say, I hereby commit to do all the same things. Can you imagine a 19-year-old missionary trying to respond to that? A second problem with the contract theory is that it is based on a very problematic moral theory. Social contract theory, at least I think it's very problematic. Surely moral obligation does not just come from tacit contracts, although sometimes some of them do. Indeed, we can easily formulate contracts that are contrary to moral obligation. Those involved in organized crime do this. And I think that the Incas did it too. They had a social contract that if you were a virgin, you could be picked to be sacrificed. And everyone sort of agreed to it, but that seems immoral. The main response to the problem of different signatures is that baptism is the only signature that matters because God will only accept this signature. A contract is only good if it is recognized. So only baptism can count as the right kind of ordinance. However, this response doesn't work because it doesn't answer the question at hand, I think. Why should God only recognize one kind of signature? What's so special about this signature? The contract theory does not tell us why God should only accept a certain kind of signature. The problem that we are encountering here is that we can seemingly explain why an ordinance is a morally significant event, but we cannot explain why it can be conventional and also necessary. Or on the other hand, we can explain why it is necessary at the cost of explaining why it's morally significant. Perhaps baptism is necessary if God mandates that baptism is the only acceptable signature. Then it would be necessary. But if God will only allow baptism as a signature, then why is this the case? Without a substantive answer, this claim seems arbitrary and flies in the face of the moral significance problem. The magic theory. I started calling this the magic theory because I thought it was such an absurd theory I wanted to disparage it in its title. And now I believe it, so. So I believe the disparaged theory. The main claim of the magic theory of the efficacy of ordinances is that an ordinance is an event that, like an incantation, causes something supernatural to happen. In particular, the idea is that baptism brings about a supernatural change in the moral nature of the person baptized. Surely this theory, if true, would explain why ordinances are efficacious. The question is whether or not it would explain why they are necessary. But before we go on to discuss whether or not the magic theory explains the necessity and efficacy of ordinances, we need to discuss what is meant by supernatural in this context. Maybe here in this audience I don't need to discuss it, but indeed by supernatural I do not mean what is usually meant. A supernatural event is not necessarily one that transcends natural law. Instead, it is merely an event that transcends our understanding of natural law. Although if Blake Osler has his way, that's not going to be the case. So really, supernatural events are perfectly natural. The point is that the magic theory asserts that baptism affects the natural world directly and thereby attains its effectiveness. This is different than the psychological theory that asserts that the effectiveness of ordinances comes via our mental attitudes, or the contract theory that asserts that the effectiveness of ordinances comes via an increase in moral obligations. As far as I understand it, this characterization fits well with what is often called the magic worldview, since the latter involves the belief that the world can be directly affected by ritualized actions. And as far as I understand it, people who accept the magic worldview don't have a distinction between God's actions being transcending law and all the other actions being within the bounds of law. But maybe if someone who's more familiar with Quinn's work than I am might be able to correct me on that. I was hoping that Mike would actually be here. But we need to be more specific about how, according to the magic theory, there is a real physical change in the person undergoing or performing an ordinance. Of course, the mechanism of change could be a variety of different things, but I'm going to tell one story that is based in Mormon folk theology and so may be familiar to some of you. This story presupposes that some kind of animism is true. That is, all things, everything that exists, is, in some sense, and a robust sense, alive, intelligent. So, for example, according to Orson Pratt, and I think Parley Pratt as well, everything is composed of uncuttable atoms, and each one of these has a degree of intelligence or consciousness. Now, if all things are alive, conscious in some sense, then perhaps it could be the case that we could communicate with things such as rocks and trees and so forth. What would be the language of communication? Well, clearly, what I'm going to say is that the magic theory says that the language of communication is ordinances. So, when we get baptized, it's like saying, I'm sorry for what I have done, and I'm turning over a new leaf, in the language that these material substances can understand. The next assumption that we need is that when we sin, we cause a physical slash spiritual change in ourselves that makes us unworthy. I say physical slash spiritual because really, at least on my view of Mormon theology, spirits matter, and although it might be more fine and more difficult to see, it's not fundamentally ontologically different than our bodies. The idea that there is such a change is not implausible on Mormon theology, since we claim that all spirit is matter and sin affects us spiritually. It follows that sin must affect us materially. This material change needs to be undone. The material stuff, let's call this stuff elements, that composes us sees baptism as the call to undo the negative physical effects of sin. And without undoing these effects, we are unworthy and physically incapable of being saved. There are many ways that this could be the case. For example, it could be that by sinning, our brains change in such a way that it makes it very much more difficult or even impossible to do what is right. Now, that might sound implausible with regard to some sins, but think about using heroin, for example. That's a very plausible explanation of that, right? Okay. Now, you're all thinking, this sounds like so much science fiction. You thought you were coming to hear a paper on philosophy, but you're getting an Orson Scott Card novel instead. I actually get the sense that Orson Scott Card, when he includes this kind of metaphysics in his science fiction novels, takes it more seriously than just a background for an interesting story. I think he actually believes it. And he certainly has a basis for that kind of belief in the work of people like Orson Pratt, or this is actually, you see it in even more contemporary theologians. Cleon Skousen's one that comes to mind, although he's not a very good example of a prominent and authoritative theologian. But notice that the magic theory would explain the efficacy, necessity, and moral significance of ordinances. Ordinances work because they change our very physical nature and thus change our abilities to do right and wrong. They are necessary because our ability to do right and wrong must change in order for us to become like God. They are morally significant because our ability to do right or wrong is morally significant. It's like almost tautologous to say that. One objection to the magic theory is that it is no better than the contract theory. Indeed, as we pointed out, the contract theorist could argue that the reason that ordinances are necessary is that God will accept baptism alone as an expression of repentance. The problem with this is that it does not explain why God should only accept baptism. But then why should things be any different for the magic theory? Indeed, why should the elements accept only baptism as a sign of repentance? The response to this objection is that the elements are stupid and God is not. The elements only know one language. They do not recognize any other way of expressing repentance. In the case of the contract theory, we can accuse God of being morally arbitrary, but we cannot accuse the elements of the same thing because they just don't understand enough. Another objection to the magic theory is that even within the church, the ordinances have changed. Indeed, we are all familiar with the change of the temple ceremony. But if this is the case, then how can we be sure that the elements can really understand what is being said? One response, maybe the only response to this objection, is that the changes to the ordinances are cosmetic and do not change the ordinance in any fundamental way. This implies that the ordinances are incredibly ancient and perhaps even eternal. It seems strange to say that we did not invent these ordinances. Of course, the main objection to the magic theory is just that it is incredibly implausible. The world just does not behave this way. We can't tell the elements what to do and have them listen to us. Instead, they are merely mechanistic obeyers of natural laws. The elements are not alive. They do not carry any degree of intelligence. All of this, like I said before, makes good science fiction, but not rational religion. In response to this objection, I should make two points. First, any serious religion that is not just some sort of warmed-over secularism in Christian clothing makes substantive claims that we have no reason to believe on scientific grounds. Christianity claims that Jesus resurrects and that Mary got pregnant without having sex. Moreover, it claims that we will resurrect and continue to live after this life. How is this, especially try to think of it from the perspective outside Christianity, you weren't raised in a Christian context, how is this any more outlandish a story, or any less outlandish a story, than the story in which elements make decisions and respond to communication? Second, nothing in science rules out the kind of story that we have told about ordinances. In fact, some seem to think that quantum mechanics is telling us that there is intelligence at the very foundation of physical reality. A lot of pop physics says this now. Now, I'm very, very skeptical of pop physics. People trying to take these physicists who teach at small colleges across the country, writing popular books explaining physics in such a way that it explains all the problems of philosophy away. I'm very wary of that, but there are a lot of people talking about it. And what I understand of quantum mechanics, I can see why they might. If the magic theory is irrational, it's not because it contradicts science, but only because it goes beyond it. But if that is the case, then all of religion is irrational, and we should just abandon it completely. A final objection focuses on the fact that Mormons believe in vicarious ordinances. How does the magic theory jive with vicarious ordinances? I'll bet you didn't think, you would have never thought that someone could use the word jive and vicarious ordinances in the same sentence. It seems that the answer is not very well. They don't go together very well. Indeed, vicarious ordinances do not involve the physical participation of the person for whom the ordinance is being performed. But doesn't the magic theory require physical participation in the ordinance? If so, then the magic theory requires, at least, that the person for whom the vicarious baptism is being performed must be present at this event. And you hear all those stories about that. Perhaps if the elements are so dumb, like I said, that they cannot distinguish between the proxy and the person for whom she proxies, then the vicarious baptism requires possession. Mormonism sounds less like an Orson Scott Card novel and now more like The Exorcist. But is that really a reason to reject it? Again, think about what I said before. Conclusion. Initially, the magic theory is the least plausible view of the efficacy of ordinances. We think that people who believe such things are superstitious, uneducated, and unsophisticated. I did when I first got on my mission. Almost all my mission companions believed the magic theory of some sort. They didn't have They didn't develop it this way, but perhaps these people are really recognizing the presupposed conditions of the necessity of ordinances. The psychological theory and the contract theory are much more plausible. They don't involve any mechanisms that a well-educated, scientifically-minded modern wouldn't accept. They don't require much in the way of faith, but they fail to explain why ordinances are necessary. Instead, they seem to imply that ordinances are optional. In the end, Mormon theology requires more. It requires a robust theory that may offend our secularist worldview. It requires seeing the world as a magical, fantastic place. But this shouldn't be too surprising. After all, a religion that does not require us to believe anything substantive that extends beyond what a minimalist scientism would allow is not worth the effort. Thanks.
Thanks, Dennis. Some very quick responses, and then I'll read part of my paper. I'm going to go backwards. Who says that vicarious ordinances do not entail spirit-body equivalent ordinances in the spirit world, where since they're embodied people, they could be doing ordinances that are kind of vicarious in the sense that they are vicariously participating with us in this world, not necessarily simultaneously, but there is that possibility that we do not see what's going on in the spirit world with respect to that. And in fact, that would say that the whole idea of sealing ordinances, the vicarious ordinances, not for the salvation of those who are in the spirit world, but for our own salvation, that it is an experience in which we are willing to do something outrageously pointless, if you will, to show our love for those who have come before us. The idea of tying the hearts of the fathers to the children and to the children of the fathers, and that notion that the ordinance is a bigger thing. We're just seeing part of the ordinance is what I'm speculating with. Who says that all Christians believe that Mary conceived without sex? In the Mormon group, we would have maybe a condescension of God there that is, again, outrageous to others. Again, a part of my underlying notion would be that how many in this room remember their baptism, if they were baptized into a Christian faith, and do you recall the experience, one that changed you, where your molecules, where your elements, you know, magically, to use the term as it's been defined, changed. Some have had that experience. And I'm just curious whether in this group there might have been some. John Taylor, when he was baptized, had an experience that just literally it was the born-again experience, but Heber Grant didn't. And they would talk about that from time to time. How different their actual experiences of baptism were. And then we have the notion of baptism being a partial ordinance. The baptism of the water and of fire is the full baptismal ordinance in Christianity. And the fire comes maybe then, maybe later, and it's an interesting notion. But both, interestingly enough, are physical, either magical realities or metaphors, or both. So I guess what I'm trying to say there, fire is a little more intense than water. It's just it's an interesting notion that baptism does go through to the bone, so you might have something there with this idea of a change that's deep. I think those are the only... I wanted to talk about the word necessary for a moment before I go into my paper. I'm taking the position that there are certain terms in analytical philosophy and general parlance that are limit terms, using linguistic theory, that are only coherent within the system, linguistic system that they're being used, and that there is no referent necessarily for something that is necessary that we would all agree to, either in experience or within outside of that system. and therefore the term necessary itself, like the term morality, are very difficult terms to come to terms with in an agreement across philosophical systems. Nevertheless, I will argue from the point of view that the term necessary isn't necessarily what Dennis seems to be defining it as. Within his system, I believe he's correct to define it as he does, but I'm taking a pragmatic view that's trying to trump his system. And you'll see why my sloppiness is based always there. And also the word morality is a problematic term. Is it something that is given by God absolutely? Or to say it another way, when Jesus said, "I am being baptized to fulfill all righteousness," was he saying righteousness is the definition of God, that which gods do is righteous, and this is an eternal ordinance or whatever that is a righteous thing and idea? Or was he saying that God defines righteousness, and I am Jesus, I am deciding that this is a righteous thing to do in my own radical freedom? That's a very important point for morality, of course. And I come from the position in this paper that morality is social custom. In Mormon parlance, though, gods are social beings authorized by those who emulate them. And therefore, we can have many kingdoms, many gods, many moralities, many goods. I think if you were to grasp my paper, it's what I'm trying to get at. There are many mansions in the heavens, plural. There are many gods, many goods. Mother Teresa might say, "No, thank you. I don't want to be in your group." She might be happy for eternity, like my father-in-law, who's a Seventh-day Adventist. He has a very different idea of what heaven would be like, and he cannot conceive of wanting to be in our kind of heaven. And perhaps better than anything else for my paper, I can use two little anecdotes. One, Martin Marty tells this story from time to time, professor at the University of Chicago of Christian history, American history, of religious history. It's told of a pagan king who was in Gaul when the first Christian missionaries came, and he was converted. And at his baptism, he said to the priest as he was going into the water, "Will I see my great ancestors in heaven?" And the priest said, "I'm sorry, you will not. You have been fortunate enough to hear the gospel, and they haven't." He stepped back out of the font and he said, "I would rather be in hell with my ancestors than be saved without them." Many of you probably resonate with Joseph Smith's famous line when he was told that, he used this line actually, it was a rhetorical piece that he used twice at least, right? Mormons are told by the sectarians that they are heretics and will go to hell. And I say, "Fine, let all the Mormons go to hell because we'll go there and make a heaven of it. I want to be with my friends in eternity." That notion of the sociality of salvation, or the salvation is not a state of being or even a place, but a set of relationships, is a very important notion both to the pagan and to the Mormon, the Latter-day Saint, I think, on one level. So here, I'm going to jump into this for a minute.
Loudly ring.
Because I've got much more to say here, and I know I'm going to go over. I mean, I'm not going to go over, so just boom.
10 minutes left.
I've got 10 on my spiel. Or is that 10 minutes in the total night?
10 minutes or less.
No, what do you want, 15 minutes to talk?
Okay, I can do about 5 minutes now. Yeah, actually,
less than 5 minutes. Okay, I'll read just the first part. Dennis Potter has given us much to consider when he suggests that ordinances are ritualized actions that are necessary for salvation. He robustly proposed a magical theory, I put the adjective there, of efficacy for sacred ritualized actions, stating that, quote, ordinances work because they change our very physical nature and thus change our abilities to do right or wrong, unquote. In this response, I will take the liberty to pragmatically define ordinances as divinely constructed forms of deliberate action, where action includes all experience of desire, thought, feeling, motion, etc. Ordinances work because acting with real intent to emulate the order of a god or the order of the Son of God, to act godlike, leads to becoming like that God. This orderly process does not abrogate the freedom of God or man to desire to cease to be godlike or to become like other gods. Are ordinances necessary for salvation? Yes and no. The notion of contingent necessity is awkward, but it is the best way to describe what Latter-day Saints often mean by an ordinance. Christian traditions have two basic interpretations of what Dennis has called rituals of salvation. For the Roman Catholics generally, sincere participation in the sacraments is sufficient, but as of late, not necessary. Not necessary for salvation, because a loving and sovereign God will make a way to save all whom he judges ought to be saved. Sacraments are efficacious, however, only as an outward sign of inward reality. Using Dennis's categories, the inward psychological state of humble faith is already there before the ritual. If not, the sacrament is not efficacious. The precise ritual form is conventional, moving from immersion to sprinkling with ease. God can still save anyone he wills to save, but most believe God is just, in some sense, not capricious. Latter-day Saints believe people can trump God's power to save them by acting so it is impossible to sustain a relationship of salvation with deity. Remarkably, the notion of contingent necessity for sacraments has won the day in most places where believers expect God to overlook such details and only judge the heart at the end of the world. When I grew up in the 1960s, the one inviolable, absolute virtue was sincerity. I don't know what it is today in high school, but that was it. You could be sincere about anything, and God would get you to heaven. In the 20th century, most Protestants and Catholics came to agree that God will save all who have not received the Christian doctrines and sacraments. I say most, by the way. If they would have sincerely done so, given the chance, sounding almost like a Joseph Smith quote there. Neither the Pope nor Billy Graham nor Gordon Hinckley believes that God will keep unbaptized children out of heaven these days. However, the Pope and Billy Graham rely on the mysterious love of God to work it out, while Gordon Hinckley adds the mysterious love between human beings who do not recall meeting those whom they act as, quote, substitute saviors on Mount Zion for. So we have our vicarious work for the dead that Joseph Smith said was so important, and I've already alluded to on why that might be a broader ordinance that's important to both sides of the transaction. Note that the sacrament has two purposes. First, it has efficacy in publicly witnessing that an important salvatory event has occurred in or for a person. To use Dennis's category, this public act creates a social contract of membership useful for order in the earthly church. It also allows a person to say clearly to himself, I am now different because my act and God's response or if you believe that, the magical act through the priest has made me whole when I submit to this ordained way of being. The submission is the efficacious act, not the particular conventional form in this case. The submission act, not the conventional form, is what is effective. Sacraments are efficacious as outward signs of personal submission and humility to God and his servants. By bowing to the sacramental tradition, one signals the inward love of God and his church, even as the Son of God did when he was baptized. In this second case, the primary content of the sacrament is less important than the willing act to submit to a mere ritual. Rather than do some grand act to prove one's spiritual greatness. For example, in the classical world, you had to do some grand act to be a noble person. The ritual was a different ritual. It was a very practical ritual. but to be brought into a certain level of society, you were required to do something. But it wasn't the Nietzschean critique of the slave religion, just anybody can go out and get dunked, you know, and be saved, those wimps. Nietzsche found this notion of being a slave to God less appealing than did St. Paul, of course. Can I keep going, or is it over? We got 10 minutes left. That's it. Yeah, I'll give another paper another time.
It's a great session. I have two comments I'd like you to respond to. In Catholic thought, there's a sacramental theology, and I'm not conversant on it, but the idea that the sacraments are the embodiment of God. So when you partake of the Eucharist, God is in the Eucharist. For a Catholic, the Catholic Church is something different than a Mormon chapel. God is there on the altar. God is literally there. So in the sacramental theology, it's something more than what we consider a symbol, and it's something less than magic, is my understanding. So there's a sense of holiness, a sense of the divine presence. So I'd like to ask you about that, how that would fit into your system. And I guess I don't buy Quinn's view of magic anyway, so I'm not sure. Magic is a complicated issue. You know, what is magic and what isn't? One man's technology is another man's magic, I think. But not everybody would agree with that. Secondly, what about a bureaucratic theory? It's necessary because God said so. I have to get into a building and use a certain card. Could use another mechanism? Yes. But God, you know, my boss tells me, because he's in charge, that you happen to use this particular card. So two theories. I'd like you to respond to those two.
Okay. On the first thing, I was thinking a lot about transubstantiation when I was doing this. And, I was at Notre Dame for a while. Maybe their views affected me, because there's a sense in which this is kind of like transubstantiation, the view that I'm arguing for about all ordinances. The way in which it's different is, for them, transubstantiation really is supernatural in the traditional sense, and it transcends the physical entirely, and transcends law and everything. I don't think anything does transcend natural law at all, period. Otherwise, it's not natural law, so I agree with Hume on that. So that's the reason that transubstantiation wouldn't quite be magic, but it's even more than magic. It's supernatural with a big S instead of supernatural with a small s. So there's a sense in which magic is more down to earth, more natural than transubstantiation would be. Now, on the sacraments, on sacrament itself, the Eucharist in Mormonism, I think that I'm not going to start saying, well, the body of Christ is in the bread or something like that. But I think what it does is it renews the effects that baptism has on us in some way, and it's got to be a physical thing. Otherwise, I can't understand how it would be necessary. As for the second question, a bureaucratic view. Actually, this is the way I want to reply to that is kind of the way I want to reply to what Randy was saying. It sounds like, to me, like the country club view, not the bureaucratic view.
You got it.
Yeah, if you're willing to do certain things, or maybe it's even the fraternal organization view, kind of like the Freemasons or something. If you're willing to go through certain things, they'll let you in, like a big fraternity. And otherwise, they're not going to let you in. Now, that's fine for working for a corporation. You have to have something to get in the building. There's some broader contextual reasons for why that needs to be the case. And it could be any kind of, it could be a card or a key, or it doesn't matter what it is, as long as there's something that keeps some people out and allows other people to go in. But I think that the context of salvation is different. And whatever it is that allows you to go in should be morally significant in and of itself. It can't just be an arbitrary thing that someone picked. Otherwise, the celestial kingdom just is a really big country club or a fraternity. And I think that makes the celestial kingdom a morally insignificant
thing. I think that the celestial kingdom should be based on the people who end up there are people who are good people and who are going to live together well. They end up in the social relations because they're good. They're not. It's not that they end up being good because they'd want to be in the social relations.
And this has just stated our difference very, very concisely and beautifully. And the notion that there is a morality that you reflect. Gods are gods because they have the characteristics of divinity, versus gods are people who define by their social relationships what they want to do together. And those who agree find themselves gods in this kingdom of this type. Those who disagree find other ways of organizing themselves and create different kingdoms of different types. And so, and I also want to say on the transubstantiation, Truman Madsen has a wonderful piece years ago on this very point. He said the difference between the Mormons and Catholics on transubstantiation is, for Catholics, the transubstantiation is in the host, but the miraculous, and he uses the word miraculous, not magical, but he'd go right with your point, is in the host. On the altar, for the Latter-day Saints, the miraculous transubstantiation is in the self, taking the bread. That he would resonate a little what you're saying there. The other thing I wanted to say on the notion of the Catholic notion of this middle way between the magical and the conventional. For the Latter-day Saint, I believe, if you think of our greatest symbols, we're an esoteric religion. We put a resurrected man at the highest point on all our temples. We have no symbols in our meetings, but we do have a high altar where we have a sacrament, and even higher than that is where human beings stand and speak to one another. So I think we have an esoteric religion where we're really saying God is a man, and here we are growing up. There, God is with us in this room. The Holy Spirit reveals that we are all sons and daughters of God. Therefore, rather than happening there in, you know, Jesus Christ literally is us, we are all Christ's, that notion. I think we can bring that back into Mormonism and really resonate with that Catholic way. We just have different beliefs.
The closer I can push my Mormon theology to warmed over secularism, the better I like it. So I've tended to be drawn to some version of Dennis, what you call the contract theory, and I'd just like to make an observation and ask a question about it. First, the observation, it doesn't seem to me, you presented it as tied to a social contract theory of ethics, and I'm not sure I understand why, and to clarify that question, the kind of contract theory that I've flirted with in the past says something along these lines. You get to a point in your moral development where you want to enter into some sort of agreement with God, saying, I'm going to promise you that I'm going to do this, that, and the other. Now, you mentioned that there's the problem of which multiple signatures. There's different ways of manifesting that assent, but it seems to me, and here I'm playing off of scriptural passages that talk about there is no other name given whereby men can be saved, something along those lines. If I'm looking for a contract to enter, when someone comes to me and says, this is how you do it, and it's as simple as getting dunked, why wouldn't, if I'm really sincere in looking for a contract to enter into with God, why wouldn't I jump on that when the opportunity presents itself? That is, it seems to me that maybe that can be the explanation for why this signature as opposed to another signature, because I'm out there looking for a signature, and this is the only one that's offered to me.
And so if I'm really sincere, that's the one I'll take.
Yeah. Versus the necessary notion, that it's kind of an internal signature.
That's a good question. Well, first of all, on the first point, you're right. It doesn't have to be associated with social contract theory. You could definitely have a contract theory of ordinances without being a social contract theorist, because you could say, I believe that sometimes in entering agreements with people, we end up having more obligations than we would have had before that, even though I'm not a social contract theorist. And yeah, you could do that. When you're giving papers at Sunstone, you just simplify things. But with regard to the second problem, I definitely think that that's a good response on the part of the contract theorist. Why wouldn't anyone accept it? And I think that that's kind of like the response to the case of the recalcitrant saint. Why wouldn't Mother Teresa accept it? But I think it's because of an epistemic distance that we have between us and the way God sees things that makes it so that we're never sure about what contracts to sign. And so it seems to me that if we go with something like what Randy was saying, all that matters really is the intention before. All that matters is that you intend to sign this kind of contract. Then that just runs right into the problem of multiple or different signatures. Multiple signatures, that's a better name for it. I think I might change that in the paper. The problem of multiple signatures. We end up, I would not like a God who didn't accept someone who sincerely signed a different contract unless there was a good reason to not accept the other contract because it does something morally significant. If it's just a matter of intention, just intention to sign the contract, you're putting yourself under those obligations. If it's just a matter of that, then all the moral significance is present when people are baptized in another religion as they are present in the Mormon case. So what I want to argue is that in order to explain why Mormon ordinances are necessary, we have to say that there's something morally significant about going through the Mormon ordinance. And we talk about the authority. I didn't get into that in this paper, but I think that that's related. I think falling out of the magic theory is a good explanation as to why there has to be authority for ordinances. There's other questions.
Actually, I was going to approach that question. There's a couple things. First of all, I'd encourage you, from my point of view, to restrict the word theology for Mormon theology to things like, grand things like the elements are eternal and spiritual, things like that, and not to the necessity of baptism. That doesn't seem to me to be a theological concept as much as a belief in the church that most of us accept. But on a completely separate topic, if you claim that in the magical theory of baptism, elements are responding to being put in water, number one, any putting in water ought to work, okay, unless you start elaborating this theory a whole lot more. If the elements are responding, if they're dumb enough to only recognize being put in water, and not being sprinkled, then the baptism of the Baptist ought to work. But if they're, they have to be fairly smart, or there has to be something else to make authority necessary here. And on the other hand, it ought to always work. If you look around and you see how many people are transformed by baptism, it doesn't seem to be everybody. If you've got a quasi-naturalistic, that is to say, magical in the Mormon, supernatural in the Mormon sense, it ought to behave some kind of laws. And I would say you have to be repentant, and that somehow fits in there, and things like that. But we have to do something to account for the disjunction between the baptism being performed and the intended effect being there.
We actually run out of time, so I'm only going to respond to the second point. Because the first one would take longer, so we can talk about it after. Randy brought that up too, and that is, well, some people feel this and other people don't. But there's plenty of physical changes that occur in me that I don't necessarily, I don't become aware of. So just because a physical change occurs doesn't mean you have to be aware of it. Also, though, I do think that the intention does need to be there. I think maybe that is part of. That's part of the ritual itself. That's part of what the elements can recognize. And so maybe that could explain it also. So there's two different ways of trying to explain it. One is maybe it always does happen. It does always happen. It's just that John Taylor's sensitive to it and George Albert Smith, right? Heber J. Grant is not. Yeah, he's not sensitive to it. And that would be me. I'm not sensitive to anything spiritual, obviously. Or it could be the other way around, and that is intention is an essential part of the ritual too, and that's something that the elements are able to recognize. And I admit that in order to develop this, you would need to talk a lot more about what this language is, this language of rituals, and show that there's some consistency in it and everything. But that was out of the scope of the paper.